This week on Potlatch, three lawyers from the lower 48 explain provisions of Public Law 93638, the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. In September, we attended AFN's workshop on PL 93638. Mike Gross, a lawyer from New Mexico, explained his background and how he began working in Native Affairs.
My present occupation primarily is that of law teacher. I'm conducting a special program in educational reform law with particular emphasis on Indian education reform for law students from Franklin Pierce Law Center in New Hampshire and five fellows or scholarship recipients from the Coalition of Indian-Controlled School Boards in Denver. I began in this field in 1968 when I first went to work as a legal services lawyer on the Navajo Indian Reservation and subsequently helped an Indian community at Rayma, New Mexico start an Indian-controlled high school. In 1971, I participated with other Indian education leaders in organizing the Coalition of Indian-Controlled School Boards, which now has over 200 members scattered around the country, including the Alaska Federation of Natives.
He told us how he got involved in the self-determination workshop, and he gave some background and history of relationships between Indians and government.
I got a call last week from the AFN asking whether I would be available to come up here and help explain and help analyze the Indian Self-Determination Act, which was just passed in Congress last year and signed by the President, and the regulations, which are now being drafted by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Department of HEW to implement that law. And this session here is designed primarily to review the regulations, analyze them, and come up with recommendations for changing them if necessary. It must be remembered that the purpose of the United States government for many years historically has been to try to work towards Indian assimilation, a process of trying to make Indians into middle-class white Americans. Of course, that whole program lingers today and is responsible in great measure for the terrible tragedy of Indian education. And in the 1920s, the Merriam Report first came to the conclusion that this course of assimilation, as it was called, was wrong, and that control of Indian education would have to be returned to Indian people before any meaningful educational reform could be achieved. The idea is, in this act, to permit Indian tribes and organizations, at their own discretion, in other words, upon their own choice, to take over government programs for their benefit, primarily in the field of education and health services. Up until now, any program run by Indians under contract to the government or drawing funds in any other way from the government has been operated at the pleasure of the executive branch of government, either the Secretary of the Interior or the Secretary of HEW. At the pleasure of means that these people, these officials, have had the discretion to choose whether or not they wanted to turn over a program to Indian control or not. Title I of the Indian Self-Determination Act, Public Law 93638, changes this. It removes discretion, or the greatest measure of discretion, from the Secretary of the Interior or the Secretary of HEW, as the case may be, and quotes, directs, unquote, him to write the contract if requested by an Indian tribe. Now, that word direct is a major innovation in federal Indian relations, and indeed was not even contemplated in the original draft of the law. The original draft of the law spoke about the secretary being authorized to write a contract upon request of an Indian tribe. Well, various organizations, including the Coalition of Indian Controlled School Boards, pointed out that that was a discrepancy. How can you talk about Indian self-determination, the right to govern your own programs, when the federal government retains the right to determine whether or not in any particular case an Indian group or tribe should run a program. So instead, it was recommended and finally adopted as law that the discretion be removed. Section 104 provides for grants in aid of self-determination to Indian tribes or organizations. Section 105 makes personnel changes that are necessary in order to make it possible for Indian tribes and organizations realistically to take over the control of previously operated federal installations like schools, where there are federal civil servants at work. Up until this act was passed, it was difficult to make any transfers because of the fear of government workers at these installations that they would either lose employment or at the very least lose their civil service benefits. So Section 105 makes it possible for former civil servants who transfer to the employment of Indian tribes or organizations under this act to retain major civil service benefits like life insurance, retirement pay, workman's compensation, and so on.
See a settler in more number, he takes whatever he encounters. You've seen the Sioux, all battered, beaten, they're all in rags, they haven't eaten. The Nez Perces were much the same. It seems like such a heartless game, and it's 1876, and the enemy's full of those death-dealing tricks. Today the treaty stands on the table. Will you sign it? Are you able? It offers food and protection to you. Really think they'll hold it true? It offers the reserve. Now isn't that grand? And in return you see all of your land. And it's 1877, and you know the scales are so uneven. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow.
To summarize, it seems to us, and when I say us, I'm talking about those who have worked with the Coalition of Indian-Controlled School Boards primarily in analyzing the regulations, it seems to us that in classic fashion, the BIA has used this opportunity to write regulations under this law to achieve BIA self-preservation rather than Indian self-determination. The BIA, in its own statement of policy, at the very beginning of its set of regulations under the law, first repeats the congressional findings by language, for example, that says the Congress has recognized the obligation of the United States to respond to the strong expression of the Indian people for self-determination. And B, the Congress has declared its commitment to the maintenance of the federal government's unique and continuing relationship with and responsibilities to the Indian people, etc. That all follows from the act itself. What's so particularly revealing, though, are the next few paragraphs in the statement of BIA policy. The language suddenly changes from what Congress has done, what Congress has found, to, quotes, it is the policy of the Bureau to facilitate the efforts of Indian tribes to plan, conduct, and administer programs, etc. Now, there's the first introduction of the word tribes. That's to say, the BIA is interpreting the phrases Indian people and Indian communities to mean only tribes. What that makes possible later on is tribal veto power over all programs of a self-determination nature. And that's something that Congress does not intend to do through this law, and something that is not really sanctioned by the language of the law itself. We are mostly concerned, in other words, with the issue of whether the BIA is installing a tribal spoil system and patronage system as a substitute for what is true true Indian self-determination. To turn to retrocession, for example, we find the BIA interpreting retrocession in such a way as to encourage tribal governments to ask for retrocession any time they feel they want to take over a program, without notice or hearing to an Indian organization that's running the program, or to the parents or the children of programs that are affected by these contracts. In other words, we find another provision right next to it, section 401.73, more or less suggesting that Indian tribes, if they wish, take over retroceded programs. Now, to give you an idea of what this really means in real life, take the case, a very sad case that occurred on the Pine Ridge Reservation a few years ago. The case concerned a private nonprofit Indian corporation made up of parents from a local community. Now, this organization was running a very successful bilingual education program under contract to the BIA. The BIA had sent evaluators to inspect the program. The evaluators gave the program highest marks. It was a successful program. But in the middle of the year, a new tribal chairman was elected. This new tribal chairman was a political opponent of the group that was running the successful bilingual program. As soon as he was inaugurated, he contacted the Bureau and asked that the contract be removed from the control of this group that had been running it and transferred to an organization that he approved of. And despite resistance from the original contracting group, the original parent group, the BIA deferred to the chairman's wishes and removed the program. Eventually, the program simply died, even though it was supposed to be a five-year program. A very tragic occurrence in terms of the welfare of those children, yet very indicative of the very system that is now going to be incorporated as federal law under these regulations unless they're changed.
That was Mike Gross. John Wabansi is an Indian attorney for the Native American Rights Fund. He gives us some of his background and that of NARF.
I'm a member of the Prairie Band of the Potawatomi Tribe of Kansas, and I've been practicing law now for 2 years with NARF. NARF is a Indian interest law firm funded primarily by the Ford Foundation to provide legal assistance to American Indians, Alaska Natives, and whatever legal problems they may have. We've done a fair amount of work in Alaska. We've represented Arctic Slope, the North Slope Borough in the boundary question, Mobile Oil Company versus the local boundary commission. We were representing the borough in that matter. Worked in Edwardson against Morton. We worked on some of the work on the Claim Settlement Act, Bush Justice Conference for AFN. And I've been up in Alaska about four times in the last year working on Johnson O'Malley and other education problems, including these regulations for PL 93638.
John compares the reservation system in the lower 48 with Alaska Natives, and he told us about some problems with the law.
The problem with the bill, the act, is that some of the sections were drafted for lower 48 tribes and did not take into consideration the unique political structure, I guess is the best term, of the Alaska Natives. The reservation system sets aside an area of land for Indians in the lower 48, and in most instances, the Indians have considerable amount of sovereignty over that land, that the Indians have the right to control certain activities within their reservation boundaries. They can control the right to hunt and fish to the exclusion of the state, for example. They control, they set laws, civil laws, divorce laws, adoption laws. They handle their own internal tribal affairs to the exclusion of any other governmental body. For example, a typical reservation like the Navajo Reservation, the Navajo tribe has the power to set up its own corporations. It has the right to set all its own laws except for major felonies. If you commit a crime on the Navajo Reservation, you'll be tried in Navajo court and tried in a court where the language is Navajo and not English. That's the biggest difference I've seen, in that exercise of sovereignty by a native people is facilitated by having a land base, having a recognized land base which you control all internal activities within. But the other difference I see is the Claim Settlement Act. The tribes of Lower 48 don't have the money that the Alaska Natives have. They don't have the structure of the regional village corporations, which have a fairly large amount of money to deal with, to work on projects for the benefit of Alaska Natives. That's one of the, you might say that in Lower 48, the tribe may have sovereignty, but the sovereignty doesn't do much because your land is worthless and the tribe hasn't got any money. Up here, there may not be the sovereignty, the territorial sovereignty, but you have money and you have land.
Well, the buffalo are slaughtered. There's nothing to eat. The government laid again with the meat, and your people are riddled with the white man's disease. And in the summer you're sick, and in the winter you freeze, and sometimes you wonder why you signed that day. But they broke the treaties themselves anyway, and it's 1889, and your Death Star explodes, and then it falls. Why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow.
What it provides, it allows for the 12 regional corporations and the village corporations to move into areas that are not devoted to making a profit. It allows them to move into the areas of delivering social services by contract, because this law has given the 12 regions and the village corporations the status as Indian tribes. They're defined, as they said, for purposes of this act, an Indian tribe is, and it lists a whole group of people, whole group of organizations, and then it says the 12 regions and village corporations established pursuant to the Claim Settlement Act. So I think it expands the powers of the 12 regions, especially the 12 regional corporations that were created pursuant to the Settlement Act. And conceivably, they can start to move into activities which are not devoted to profit-making. The problems it could create is that the bureaucracy will no longer be run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It'll be a stifling Bureau of Indian Affairs bureaucracy. But now you'll have an Indian bureaucracy. And some people say, okay, that's a better thing. It's better to have a tribally oriented bureaucracy rather than a non-Indian Bureau of Indian Affairs bureaucracy. That conceivably could be one of the results. And unless the tribe works hard to cut that down, that may be the result. That you just simply shift, the bureaucrats change colors. Instead of white bureaucrats, now you have Indian bureaucrats. Now, the big problem with this bill, though, is it's not sufficiently funded. There's not enough money right now to fully fund even half of the contract proposals that have been filed already. Congress has to appropriate more money for Indian affairs.
That was John Waubonsie. Attorney Jacob Pompan was also at the 93-638 workshop at Anchorage, and he told us how he became involved in the conference. He also explains the changes brought about by the Self-Determination Act.
The practice of the firm and my practice is primarily in the government contract arena. I speak occasionally for a group that does training in the procurement area, and during one of those in San Francisco, I ran into a group of Native Alaskans. Carl Jack was among them, Trefon Angerson. It was a good presentation down there, and the Alaska Natives were very, very interested in it, and they were very interesting people, and as a result of that meeting, they subsequently, about 4 months later, invited me up here to hold a full contract administration or basic procurement course, which I did. I had done a great deal of that in the service, and out of that, I think, came a relationship between AFN and Alaska Natives and myself. I became very interested in what I saw up here, in the need for a deeper understanding of contracts and a willingness and a desire on the part of the Native to understand this new theory. It's very, very, very important to recognize that what is fundamentally taking place is a change from a fiduciary relationship between the federal government and the Native to a contractual relationship. But what this public law has done is to take the fiduciary relationship in many areas and give the Native the opportunity to make it a more formalized relationship, one in which I feel that the Native can prosper under if he understands it. But he must first understand the basic difference between a fiduciary relationship, which is one of trust, understanding between people, and a dependence of one person upon another. Now, the contract relationship is different. The contract relationship depends on a written document. And the seminar is going into the laws and the regulations that promulgate and implement that law, and we're talking about words. That's a very, very difficult thing to do, is to go through a clause on subcontracting and take it word by word and try to understand whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether it ought to read this way, whether it ought to read that way. And recognizing also that even if you decide it ought to change, that back in Washington, the bureaucracy that lives there is unlikely to make any change. And they have all the reasons in the world why they shouldn't change this clause, because the clause has been like this for years, and hundreds and thousands of man-hours in some cases have been applied to make the words say precisely this. And then we come by and we say, hey, we don't like these words. We have made it apparent to many people in this seminar that, number one, it's very, very difficult to deal with regulations. They're hard to understand. The other thing is that these regulations will control the relationship, and that's the important thing. I think one of the major problems is whether or not the Native wants to assume responsibilities of a program. We should not assume responsibilities merely because the opportunity is there. We should assume the responsibility only when we are confident that we can carry out those responsibilities, and when we're confident that the government is operating at a standard or at a level that is consistent with its own standard. In other words, we shouldn't take over a hospital or a service when a building is currently in violation of the fire code or the Occupational Safety and Health Act. For if we fail to meet those standards, you may rest assured that the government has the option of reassuming that responsibility. And I guess could consider reassumption as a black mark. Reassumption is a sign of failure, any way you cut it. And we should do what we can to make sure that the government is not given the opportunity to reassume a program because we failed to carry out our obligations as contractors to the people who are the beneficiaries of the program. Just like Boeing and Lockheed and Douglas recognize that their survival as a corporation, their stockholders, depends upon how well they can operate within the contractual environment with the government, so you too must recognize that your survival in terms of the maximum benefit under the law depends upon how well you operate within the contractual environment that's being now set up.
The years have gone, the years have flown, the nation since has swiftly grown, but yet for the native, it's all the same. There's still the hardship, there's still the pain, there's still the hardship, there's still the strife. Its bitterness shines like a whetted knife. There's still the hypocrisy, and the hate was bad in the treaties. Is that the fate? We're all unhappy pawns in the government's game, and it's always the native who gets the blame. It's a problem which money can never lessen, and it's 1971. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Maybe one day you'll find honesty instead of the usual treachery. Perhaps one day the truth may prevail, and the warmth of love which it doesn't take. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow.
This music that we've been listening to is taken from Willie Dunn's album and excerpts from The Ballad of Crowfoot. Finally on this program, Jacob Pompan tells us what self-determination means to him.
It's opportunity to get these nice things and do these nice things that the Congress said here in Section 3 policy. It's opportunity to get them. It's a challenge. Are you up to the challenge of doing the job properly? And it's responsibility. Now, responsibility means that when we sit in a seminar with 15 people, that there shouldn't be just two people talking. It means studying the regs. It means recognizing that there's nobody in the government, even though they wrote this law, there's nobody in the government staying up late at night thinking, how can I help the Indians and the natives get self-determination? What can I do? There's nobody doing that. They wrote the law. Now it's up to you. You have to take it. You have to study it. You have to manipulate it. You have to make it work for you. And that's responsibility. That's challenge. That's opportunity. So I say that this is where you have to fish or cut bait. Fiduciary is great. It's great for us to say, I had a great white father up there. Help me. It's great to fight. It's great to say you got to be taken care of. It's great to say you want the opportunity. Well, now, what you got here, it seems to me, is the beginning of the opportunity to stand up and take the cudgel in your hand and make the system work for you. Make the system work for you.
This has been Moses Wasley, and thank you for listening.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.